We're talking genomic AI next on the program. Welcome to Mendel's Pod. I'm Theral Timpson. Today's show is part of a special series we're putting together with Genome Web. So welcome to our audience and welcome to the Genome Web audience. What problems is AI being used for in precision medicine? To answer this question today, we're joined by Kyle Kaihow-Farr. He's the VP and distinguished scientist at Illumina's Artificial Intelligence Lab. Welcome to Mendel's Pod.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is cool. Illumina has an AI lab. Could you give us a little background on your team? How long has the Illumina AI lab been going? What brought about the investment in this?
Of course. Yeah. So we started the Illumina AI lab about 7 years ago. And the motivation for this is that most of Illumina works on building a better sequencer and helping you generate huge amounts of data. And now we're thinking, you know, how do we actually make sense out of it? How do we, interpret these variants that we're getting out of sequencing each person's genome? That was kind of also when deep learning was first taking off. So we're very glad to have sort of gotten ahead of the curve. And actually, a couple of our AI algorithms, like Splice AI, Primate AI, these were published in Cell and Nature Genetics in 2018, 2019. These actually represent the first examples of deep learning algorithms in genomics that have become widely used for helping clinical labs and researchers interpret variants of unknown significance.
Congratulations on that. Yeah, so I want to drill down into those two products. But first, can you give us sort of a general overview of what you think genomic AI is?
Absolutely. So if you think about the workflow of, you know, what happens when you sequence a genome, all the way to how do you get insights out of it? When you sequence a genome, it's typically about, 100 billion nucleotides. And then that's now passed to our state-of-the-art secondary analysis software, Dragon, which now calls the 4 million positions where each one of us differs from everyone else in the human population. And that's where genomic AI really starts. So now we're focused on the question of, for your 4 million variants that make each of us our own individuals, how do we interpret out of that huge haystack, what is the handful that are actually medically or clinically relevant? And now we now develop specific AI algorithms like Primate AI or Splice AI, which now filter these variants to identify which ones have the potential for pathogenicity.
What are the challenges in using AI in this specific use case?
Well, I think if you look at other successful AI programs, like we'll say ChatGPT for now, since that's kind of the most famous, you have a problem where humans have generated immense amounts of training data. So as you might be familiar, the way ChatGPT is trained is it can read something like Wikipedia and it's asked to predict the next word in a sentence. And by learning how to predict the next word in a sentence from all the words that have come before, in the paragraph, it essentially learns grammar and how to give coherent responses to prompts. So that's a problem where humans have generated enormous amounts of training data, and you basically just plug in a attention transformer network, and it can just go from there. When it comes to interpreting human genetic variants, we have the problem that humans really can't interpret variants at all. So if you say in the human genome, base 2 billion and 6A turned to C, does that cause disease or not? There's no human who can actually really tell you that. So therefore, we lack a way of training AI as readily as you would for, natural language processing, say.
Yeah, I totally get that. We've been using language, for instance, for thousands of years. New words come in here and there. But there's lots of use cases for the AI to go out and use books and articles and all kinds of things. What you're saying in genomics is there's not that vast amount of data it can train itself on.
Well, there's vast amounts of data, but for the most part, there's no labels for what the correct answer should be. So the secret of machine learning is that for the most part, we get these incredibly powerful networks, but we tell it, here's the input and here's what you need to predict. So that's supervised learning. And up to now, we've been able to get great results by, you know, supervising using Wikipedia and books and internet content humans have written. But now if you're giving it a genome and you're asking for, you know, position 2,000,000,006 A turn to C, you now have to label it as benign or pathogenic. And since no humans can do that, we need to find clever ways to go beyond, you know, what humans themselves can do. So to that extent, one of the most powerful tools that we found has been just using clues from natural selection. So in our recent paper, PrimateAI 3D, this came out as a series of four papers back to back in Science. Mm-hmm. In these papers, we describe using sequencing from non-human primate species to provide information on what kinds of mutations are going to be tolerated by natural selection and which ones are going to be rejected. So that is actually the signal that we use to train our AI on which variants are going to be benign or pathogenic.
Wow, that seems phenomenal. Training on natural selection. Where do you learn from natural selection, and what kind of markers are you looking for?
Yeah, we were kind of inspired by just thinking about the large human sequencing cohorts. So right now, if you sequence, say, like a rare disease patient, and they have 4 million variants, I told you each person has 4 million, you're trying to find the one variant that causes their disease. The first step you do is you just ask, of those 4 million variants, which ones are already common in the population? Because if they're common, that means that natural selection has essentially blessed them for not causing anything really bad. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, they'd be very quickly removed. So that's very powerful. And sequencing large cohorts like Thousand Genomes or NOMAD Project have allowed us to build very large catalogs of common variants that we can use to filter against. So a set of 4 million variants can be filtered down to just a few hundred by removing all the variants that are common and therefore sort of tolerated by natural selection. So this is essentially an extension of that. We're basically doing catalogs of what are the common tolerated variants in each species of primates. And to that extent, we sequenced members of 233 primate species. So it increased the number of variants we have to use to filter by, you know, 200 fold since we have that many more species. And altogether, it allows us to expand the set of sort of known variants. I think, you know, previously ClinVar was about 70,000 variants. We can now expand that to almost 4.5 million variants interpreted using this technique.
Okay, so you mentioned ClinVar. Does that help you, that database? Because aren't those reported pathogenic variants?
ClinVar is a database of both benign and pathogenic variants. It's actually about two-thirds benign variants, one-third pathogenic. But the main problem is that it's too small. So it mainly contains coding variants. Out of the protein coding variants, it only represents 0.1% of the missenses. And for non-coding, it hardly represents any. So it's just vastly too small for the problem.
Wow. So we're going really beyond ClinVar at this point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, when it comes to interpreting a genome, we're really only at the very beginning of our journey. Yeah. So by sequencing these primates, what we've done is we've increased the number of known variants by about 70-fold. And now we finally have a data set that's large enough to train the most powerful machine learning methods.
Wow, very cool. This is really neat. And something I had not heard before. So there are probably others who are doing this, I would assume, you know, not only in companies, but maybe in research facilities. What are the key advantages to what Illumina is doing? Or what's, you know, makes you a little bit different?
Yeah, I think us being Illumina, we are able to, you know, reach out to sort of all the primatologists around the world. So and really put together kind of a joint partnership and effort to do that. So in our sort of industry academic consortium here, we have over 70 academic authors on our four science papers. Most of them are people who actually went out to the jungle and, you know, caught the monkeys to provide the samples with. So it was really the ability to leverage Illumina's sequencing to generate vast quantities of training data that I think made all this possible. Because otherwise, it'd be very difficult to get grant funding to make this kind of sequencing happen. And then I think the second part is that you now need to bring that data together with really powerful machine learning models. And I think, you know, one challenge going forward is that deep learning compute has really become very unaffordable for many labs in academia, at least at the scale needed to get the most powerful and most effective models. I think, you know, we recently are looking at some large language models, and they were going to take decades to train, actually, if you only use like a single server with 8 GPUs. So the amount of data and the amount of compute is simply staggering in order to get the best AI performance.
And you've been building up the resources there in that lab for
I would say that, you know, we're not at Facebook or Google's level, but, you know, we're also not trying to build general AIs. So for the specific question of, you know, how do we build the most successful genomic AIs for interpreting someone's genome? You know, we're well-resourced to be successful for that, both on the data generation side and on the model construction side.
That's super exciting. Really, really exciting. Let's get back into this project that you mentioned, the Primate AI 3D, and talk about recent innovations such as Splice AI. Just say a bit more about those two things.
Yeah, so Primate AI 3D, I sort of told you one of the key innovations was the insight that we could use natural selection to train the model and therefore get labels for variants that normally you wouldn't be able to get, because unlike a task like language, where humans are experts, can provide the training data, here humans really don't have a clue. So we have to find, you know, clues directly from the science and from natural selection from the data.
Yeah, I mean, you're really pushing biology in new areas.
You know? Absolutely. It's very convenient that we're essentially harvesting the results of millions of years of natural experiments to tell us which variants are benign or pathogenic. But the other part is that I mentioned that this is Primate AI 3D. So the other aspect is that we actually utilize the latest 3D structures from deep learning protein folding models. So now we can superimpose on top of that the locations of these benign variants from primates. And from that, we can figure out which are the sort of pockets where the pathogenic disease-causing variants are. So those are basically the places where benign variants are utterly depleted from these 3D protein structures. Yeah. And a lot of times, you know, these pockets of parts of the protein are very obvious in 3D space, whereas they're quite disconnected in linear space in the genome. So putting all that together in 3D structures was also key for sort of the next level of improvement. And then finally, I'd mentioned, you know, the way that ChatGPT is trained is you're trying to predict the next word in Wikipedia. We also do the same thing, except that in the 3D structure, we sort of blot out the amino acid with the variant and then ask it to fill in the blank for what that amino acid might be. So then if the variant creates an amino acid that fits well into that jigsaw puzzle, then we say it's more likely to be benign. If it doesn't fit, then we say it's more likely to be pathogenic. So it's sort of a 3D version of what ChatGPT does and trying to fill in the blank for these proteins.
Wow, cool. And you created this 3D software yourself?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just fantastic. One thing that keeps coming to my mind is, since you talked about learning from natural selection, there are still pathogenic variants that natural selection didn't eliminate, right? So the ones we have, right? I mean, that's right. CF, like for cystic fibrosis, or this one that Casgevy goes in and takes care of with, you know, sickle cell anemia.
Right, right.
So how do you explain that?
It's just a matter of time, I think. So evolution works on, you know, grand scales that go far beyond an individual lifespan. So, you know, these pathogenic variants will eventually be eliminated by natural selection, but they're also being counteracted by the production with each generation of new mutations, which have to be filtered. So all of us are kind of at a steady state right now between evolution's ability to remove deleterious variants and the new ones that just, you know, naturally occur with each generation. As you know, many rare disease patients are, their causal variants are de novo that just occurred in them and weren't present in parents. Yeah. Obviously, because of the negative effects of those variants, many of those patients will not be able to have children. So that's basically, you know, the action of natural selection, even in our own timelines.
True. So these 4,000 that you feel safe with, mm-hmm. Again, explain to me how you know there's no pathogenic variants within those, because your theory is they'd be gone by now. So is it because of the time scale you're looking at?
Yes. So it's a set of numbers, right? The ClinVar database had annotations for about 70,000 missense mutations, so protein alter mutations. Our study now brings us up to 4.5 million, which are annotated. So increasing that by 60 to 70 fold. So within them, there probably are still a very small number of pathogenic variants. But we showed basically by overlapping that with variants that are in ClinVar that it's probably over 99% of these variants are benign. So there's a small number, you know, due to recent mutations that haven't been cleared yet by natural selection. But as long as the data is mostly clean, deep learning is able to sort of generalize and work around that.
Yeah. So sorry, I meant 4 million instead of, well, I said 4,000.
No problem. Yeah.
Okay. So you've been on this journey of training AI algorithms to unlock the genome. Let's maybe go into the translational space a little bit. Like, what are you having insights? Are you uncovering insights? What might some of those, an example of those, be?
Absolutely. So I mentioned that, you know, we had four papers that came out in Science this summer. Only one of them was actually about the training of the Primate i3D deep learning network. Another one highlighted the application of these AI algorithms to large-scale biobanks like the UK Biobank. So there we've been looking at the potential for the AI algorithm to provide much better results for genetic risk prediction, precision medicine, polygenic risk scores, and then new discovery of gene phenotype relationships, which could potentially be, you know, candidate therapeutic targets of the future.
Very true. So a lot of the results of this could just be new discovery, basic science.
Yeah. So one of the things that we're able to show is that when you use Primate i3D, you can get these beautiful correlations between the sort of pathogenicity that's predicted by our AI algorithm, and then quantitative phenotypic measures like blood cholesterol level or blood pressure or blood glucose. So you can show that, you know, someone's blood cholesterol level is very well predicted by their Primate i3D score for the variant that they carry in the LDL gene or in the PCSK9 gene. So this allows you to quite accurately predict who will be at risk for diseases like dyslipidemia or type 2 diabetes or any one of these things. And it allows you to do so with rare variants rather than the common variant polygenic risk scores that we're sort of more used to hearing about. This has many advantages, but namely, a couple of them are that because these are rare variants, they have much larger effect sizes than the variants that go into GWAS or polygenic risk scores. So it's much easier to identify people who are at greatest risk of disease rather than, you know, you do your 23andMe test, you get a PRS that says your risk of diabetes is 1.2 fold above the general population. Okay, great. What do you do with that? So now you get back results that are more like, you know, threefold or fourfold. These are much more actionable medically for screening the population. The other thing that it allows is that unlike the polygenic risk scores based on common variant GWAS, which are frequently affected by ancestry issues. So if they're trained on European GWAS, they tend not to generalize well to non-Europeans. This is all based on rare variants, and it's grounded in Primate i3D. Which is ultimately trained on primate data, not human data. Mm-hmm. So we find that this can provide the first polygenic risk scores, which are not affected by ancestry bias. So we showed that it works roughly equally well in Europeans and non-European populations.
Now, is the use of your AI, for instance, the primate AI, is it available to customers? Is it still a Absolutely. Research project? It's available. Yes. It's available. Yeah. So this is out there then. This is making a difference.
Absolutely. And this has recently been released. So we're still getting uptake across the field, but we're essentially putting it out in all of our software products for Illumina. So Dragon, Basebase, ICA, eMenching. And then at the same time, we're also making it available for academic researchers free of charge as well. So really just trying to get it out there to help people get the most value out of genomes as much as possible in every way. And then an algorithm that you had mentioned earlier, Splice AI, mm-hmm. Which we published in Cell a few years ago, that is sort of on the flip side in that it's interpreting non-coding variants that cause disease. So PrimateAI3D interprets coding variants. And then I would say on the non-coding side, because SpliceAI has been around a little bit longer, it has been adopted by virtually every clinical lab now for helping them identify pathogenic variants in the non-coding genome.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's out. So what are next steps for you at the lab? Can you give us a hint
about, yeah, absolutely.
I know you can't say everything, but I'm just curious where you go from here.
Yeah, I think there's many, many exciting directions. So one of the exciting directions is actually experimental. So we've been doing large-scale PerturbSeq experiments. PerturbSeq is where you basically use CRISPR to make a mutation, and then you can read out the effects of that mutation using a single cell assay. So essentially every single cell gets a different mutation, and now you can read that out. So we have a preprint up, and that paper is now in review. We essentially make every mutation in some key disease genes, and now we can read out which mutations are pathogenic or benign just based off the single cell expression signature of the cell that received that variant. So we essentially have turned the NovaSeq into a genome interpretation platform.
Right, all in one.
Yeah, so that's super fun. And then we're learning a lot about how to better interpret variants through these kinds of experimental studies. So essentially these will further train our AI. The AI will nominate new experiments to be done and we'll repeat that virtuous cycle. And then I think on the other side, we're very excited about further adding more AI algorithms that will help decode the rest of the genome besides the 1% that's protein coding. So we're working on algorithms that will help identify all the pathogenic variants in promoters, in 3' UTRs and enhancers. So the goal is that as these come out over the next few years, it'll make the whole genome much more useful over looking at panel or exome sequencing alone. Because many of the previously undiagnosed cases, as you know, for rare disease, our diagnostic rate is about 30%. So we're missing like 70% of diagnoses. We all suspect that many of these are actually in things like promoters, enhancers, UTRs. The variants are called, they're hiding in plain sight. We just need the tools that actually give people the ability to call out, which one of these are actually breaking the gene and causing disease. So really excited about getting those out to help move the whole field from exome and panel over to whole genome sequencing.
Mm. And so, so these new tools integrated with whole genome sequencing could move the needle on the rare disease diagnosis.
Absolutely. I think, right now, the truth is our diagnostic rate of exome is 30%, and that's very unsatisfying, I think, for patients and physicians.
For sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're going to be beefing up the algorithms. You're going to integrate it mm-hmm. into, the tools, the whole genome. So now let's just finish up by just, looking out there a bit, maybe 5-10 years. How do you see AI impacting genomics? Long term, maybe you've had some ideas about this.
Yeah, I think that over the next decade, as AI continues to improve, our hope is that when you sequence someone and you get, 4 million variants, we'll be able to immediately interpret all of them for which ones cause disease or not. So right now, people in genomics frequently describe this as being a variant of unknown significance problem, and mm-hmm. that being a major barrier to the adoption of genetics clinically, because, right now when a poor physician orders their genetic test, it usually doesn't come back with a yes or no answer. It usually comes back with, hey, we found a VOS, and we don't exactly know what it does. And then, the poor, nephrologist who works on kidney disease is like, okay, I'm never going to order another genetic test again. Yeah, because, they don't know what to do and what to say to the family. So the hope is to really completely stamp out VOSs and just get, clean answers for every genetic test that's given out, because now we know for every variant, is it benign or pathogenic, even when it's an encoding. So I think that is one huge goal, and one that will, quickly enable the adoption of sequencing in our medical system. Because right now, when we're stuck with 99.9% of variants being unknown, it's just, very, very difficult to make traction. And then I think the other one is that there's going to be an unprecedented wave of new discovery from large-scale cohorts that are being sequenced. A lot of countries are now sequencing their entire populations. So we're working very closely with them to help them deliver precision medicine insights, like genetic risk prediction with the rare variant polygenic risk score for individual patients. But then you can also look at these large-scale cohorts to do novel discovery. So as you guys are all familiar with, about a decade ago, people discovered that people who carry natural mutations that break the PCSK9 gene have naturally low levels of cholesterol and are protected from heart attacks. So very quickly, pharma was able to make antibodies which inhibit PCSK9, and now that's a fantastic drug. So I think that there's many, many other genes like this out there where natural occurring mutations are beneficial and are great potential therapeutic targets for all kinds of diseases. And ultimately, AI is actually also central for identifying those, because we need to figure out which mutations actually are affecting the gene compared with the sort of, the needles that are affecting the gene versus the haystack of variants that don't do anything. So again, I think AI is going to be crucial and help us interpret those variants and pull out these potential future therapeutics.
That sounds so promising, really. The VUS, problem, variants of unknown significance, improving that, but also just all this could really just be jumping up research a major level, it sounds like. Great. Kyle Kaihau Farr from Illumina's AI Lab. This has been terrific. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And thank you again for having me.